talking to Chris Koch, and this is the, what are we up to, the second, third of?
Fourth.
Fourth. Fourth of October, 1994. Right. Okay. Well, what I'd like to do is just start chronologically from the time that you joined the station and how you happened to do so.
Well, I was living in El Cerrito at the time, and listening to KPFA was a truly extraordinary experience in 1959, when there was simply nothing else remotely like it on the air in terms of the range of opinion that it broadcast and its commitment to serious ideas in drama, literature, and public affairs areas. It's the comprehensive nature of its news and its concern with traditional culture and classical music. There was nothing else remotely like it on the air, and to listen to it was really to almost, it was almost like looking through a crack in a very monolithic 1950s American culture is what it was. I mean, it must have been somewhat akin, not to exaggerate, but somewhat akin to listening to a Western radio station from behind the Iron Curtain in years to come, because America was extremely conformist then. And I went down, and Harold Winkler was the manager, and said, do you ever hire people? And they said, no, but we do take volunteers. And so I volunteered, and it turned out the first day of work was, God, I think it was April 18th, but you could check. It was the day the students were washed down the stairs in the City Hall Rotunda, and it was funny because Harold Winkler had asked me, how many foreign languages do you speak? And I said, well, I can read a little bit of Spanish and French, and I mean, never had the reason to use any foreign language in Pacifica, but anyway. And when I arrived on Black Friday, the entire operation under Elsa Knight Thompson's command had gone over to the City Hall Rotunda in San Francisco to observe the students' demonstrations and the students then being washed down the stairs of the City Hall Rotunda.
Burton White.
Burton White was over there. Yeah. Fred Haynes was over there with a microphone. Fred had just gone to work there. Elsa did not come over. She stayed back at the studio. Fred did some incredible reporting. Mike Tiger.
Yeah, right.
Was over there as well, doing some incredible reporting at that. And I was there outside with the recording interviews and sounds with the San Francisco Longshoremen's Unions giving advice, like, when the horses charge, roll, roll ball bearing balls under their feet. You know, that'll make the horses. I mean, it was really quite heady stuff.
Yeah.
And I guess I volunteered for about 3 months doing... as a production assistant, doing, you know, managing the tapes and writing on-air continuity, and then they hired me to run the production department. And I went on the air first with Fred Haynes. Fred Haynes was an announcer at that point. I think Fred was there before me. Fred was an announcer, and he said one day, would you like to learn how to announce? And I said, well, that'd be fun. So I walked in, and he said, okay, sit down here at the board. And I sat down. He said, okay, now when the record's over, you turn this pot down, stop that record with this hand, turn this pot up, read that copy, turn this pot down, turn this pot up, let that record go, and, you know.
Combo operation.
Combo operation. And then it was, you're on the air. And Elsa Knight Thompson came storming in after my first announce and said, if you must be on the radio, at least learn how to talk properly. And hauled me into her office. And
that was back when it made a difference.
And began giving me voice lessons. I mean, she was...
Oh, yes. Yes, there were actually things like production values. And
there were very strong production values. I mean, I don't know who was primarily responsible for the sound of the kind of overall concept, but Elsa was certainly very, very powerful in the public affairs and news area, and I think indirectly in culture. And basically her standards were very old-fashioned BBC.
Yeah. Well, she was
standards.
At that point practically the only person there. at least sort of full-time on the staff, who had a firm foundation in radio practice going back a long way.
That's absolutely right, and that's absolutely right. She was. She had done a great deal of radio, and she had very strong opinions about it, and they were all right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually.
As it turned out, I'll tell you one anecdote I remember well, you know, just talking about standards in comparison to today. One of our reporters, and this happened later after KPFA was on the after KPFK in Los Angeles was on the air, one of our reporters in Los Angeles infiltrated the American Nazi Party, then run by George Lincoln Rockwell. Now, Rockwell at one point was a commentator on Pacifica.
Mm-hmm. So
we had a commitment to broadcasting all points of view. We also had Dorothy mm-hmm. Healy, of course, who was then chairman of the Southern California Communist Party.
I remember very well Rockwell's being interviewed by Byron Bryant with fine impartiality and dignity.
Exactly. So we had no objection to him being... We believed that he had the right to be on the air. But, of course, we also... Elsa having lived through Europe in those horrible years of the 40s when Hitler was storming about... But this reporter had infiltrated the American Nazi Party and done a series of incredible recordings secretly, which revealed a great deal about what they thought privately, which they were hesitant to say publicly. And Elsa refused to allow the tape to be broadcast. She said, "We will not engage in the practices of totalitarian states and record without the knowledge of someone something they're saying and run it in the air. That is not done."
Mm-hmm.
People must know that they are speaking for the public record. They have to be recorded openly and obviously. Otherwise, it's entrapment, and it's simply not fair. And can you imagine anyone in broadcasting today articulating a similar...
Broadcasting in anything.
In anything, exactly. I mean, there's a standard of morality. Now, we fought with her bitterly. We said, mm-hmm. "You're wrong, Elsa. These people are beyond the pale. They, we know about the Nazis. I mean... anything to stop them." She said, "No, you're wrong." She said, "We will not engage in the tactics of totalitarian states to preserve democracy. It's not done." Mm-hmm. That's the way you erode the standards.
And well, that parallels in a much stronger way that milder incident that I cite with Rick Curito and Lou Hill about making fun of a DAR woman on the air.
Exactly.
That kind of a standard.
Yeah. It was a very high standard that people were held up to. And it was unique, I think, and it must have been part and parcel of its time, because Pacifica, clearly, as we know from its history, particularly after 1965, which is when I left, although I see myself as being coincidental in the change, went really found itself extremely susceptible to the appeal of a very different set of standards, of personal journalism, of just all kinds of different things, which was another phase.
Well, what the stations went on to, I don't want to get bog myself down.
Not my phase. I left in 65. I was gone in 65. Although I came back for 1 year to KPFK in 1969 and 70, or 68, 69, I spent a year at KPFK in Los Angeles as a public affairs director, where I did a radio show, a live radio show for a year. But that was the last contact with Pacifica.
Yeah. Now, the time zone that I'd like to zero in on, which you were closely involved with from, by that time, I think from the other side, but your, how well do you remember your little mini history of Pacifica that you wrote in the late 60s that I quote from?
Well, that I wrote for Eleanor. I think Eleanor, that was Eleanor's book, wasn't it? Eleanor McKinney's book.
No, there was that, but there was also one separate from that, which you were...
I don't remember it at all. I remember Eleanor McKinney's On Working at Pacifica was the title of Eleanor McKinney.
Yeah, but you actually wrote a history... substantial history, 5,000-6,000 words anyway?
Yeah, you mentioned that, actually. I do not recall that.
And
that was in a folio.
It was published in a folio, but it was reprinted in a folio, and it had been, it was about 1972 or so, the folio, but it...
I'd love to see it, John.
Right. Okay, I'm going to stop this for a moment.
is Larry Lee. My God. Trevor Thomas. There's Trevor. God, he looks so young. We thought he was so old. And Alec Hoffman. Oh, my God. Russell Jorgensen. Oh, my God. Name slide. Let me get this. Can I have this copy?
Right.
Are you now? Have you ever been? Can they ask me that?
Yeah. Well, what I wanted to zero in on really was that at the time of the CIS investigations, 1963, and the simultaneous renewal of the licenses.
Yeah.
Because I was there in that room in Trevor's office when they had the staff meeting at which. Well, there's a favorite New Yorker cartoon of mine of a secretary reading the minutes and this collection of businessmen sitting around, and she's reading. The meeting was called to order for 60 minutes. Everybody sacrificed his personal integrity. The meeting was adjourned. And it's more or less my memory of that meeting when people talked themselves unwillingly into...
It was not a high moment.
...into feeding Jerry...
Jerry Shore.
Jerry Shore to the wolves.
Mm.
Do you... Now, do you happen to know, for one thing, under the... I know under these new laws, one can gain access to all kinds of public records that... I see. I haven't put this on.
Never mind. Doesn't matter. One can gain access to all kinds of public records that one couldn't before. And has anybody gone after the records of CIS and of the FCC from about that time?
No, I don't. Not to my knowledge. Of course, you know, the hearings themselves were published. I mean, they were published. There is a published version of the hearings, the record of the hearings. But of course, the conversations that took place. You know, behind closed doors. Actually, I think the key conversation took place in the men's room at some place, but I was not present for that.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. It is pretty obvious. It was pretty obvious to all of us that the CIS hearings came about as a result of an interview that Richard Ellman and myself did with a defector from the FBI.
Mm-hmm. Was that Turner or
Special
Levine?
Special Agent Jack Levine.
Levine, yeah. Levine was first, wasn't he?
Levine was the first. Yeah. And it was an interesting time because I walked into the station one morning and Dick Ellman came into my office. I was then acting station manager and said, I'd like you to meet Special Agent Jack Levine, Federal Bureau of Investigation. And of course, I thought, oh God, here it comes. You know, because we always expected to be, you know, raided by the... the government in one way or another. He said in kind of a high voice, no, former special agent. And it turned
out
that Jack had left the FBI and wanted to tell his story. And he had gone to every newspaper and magazine in New York City, maybe America. I mean, he had gone to an incredible list of magazines and newspapers. Nobody would touch Jack Levine with a 10-foot pole. Finally, Kerry McWilliams at The Nation did a short piece on Levine in which he asserted that one out of every seven members of the Communist Party, the American Communist Party, was an FBI informer or plant. And Kerry picked that up and ran that, but Jack had much more to say than that. And Kerry suggested he come down and talk to us at Pacifica. Richard Ellman and I interviewed Levine for, I think, 3 or 4 hours. And we took the interview and we cut it down to an hour and a half, as I remember, an hour and a half, a 90-minute interview. And basically the stuff that was most interesting, other than the FBI other than the Communist Party infiltration assertion, were things about Hoover's personal personal style that at that point were revelations. In fact, they were not believed. I mean, the fact that FBI agents carried two handkerchiefs, one to wipe their hands and one to their vest pocket.
The sweaty palm syndrome.
The sweaty palm syndrome and the fact that, you know, he was capricious, the fact that I don't even think we got into his possible relationship with men. I think that didn't even get into the interview. But it was personal stuff like like, you know, capricious decisions. Anyway, it wasn't, by today's standards, it would not be considered that broad an attack. But for the 1950s, yeah. early 60s,
compared with that biography that came out about a year ago.
It was very tame stuff. But it was the first. No one had ever attacked J. Edgar Hoover or the FBI before, ever in any way. And as soon as we took the interview, after we edited it down, we took it to a number of Washington attorneys, among them Ephraim London, who was at that point one of the leading civil liberties and civil liberties attorneys mm-hmm. in the country. And Ephraim London read it, and we said, do you think we ought to run this stuff? Because we were very nervous. And he said, you would be doing a disservice not to run this material. Mm-hmm. So we printed a transcript up, distributed it widely, and the calls began to come in. I mean, it was unbelievable. People, I remember one from the Associated Press reporter who called and said, listen, Mr. Koch, I know you got to meet me down at this bar. And we met at this bar, in a dark bar someplace down on Lexington or 3rd Avenue. I think it was 3rd Avenue. And he sat down, big kind of typical, heavy smoking, hard drinking reporter. And he says, listen, I know you kids think you're doing a great thing here, but I want to tell you, your life will be ruined if you go ahead with this broadcast. You got to cancel this broadcast. Eleanor Bunny, what was Bunny's first name? Bunny Bruce, who was our folio editor, who had close contacts with the AFL-CIO, got a call from the educational director of the AFL-CIO in Washington saying, Bunny, when that program goes in the air, don't be on the station because it's going to be attacked. And it was like, 20, 30, 40, 50 calls a day warning us against doing this broadcast. Mm-hmm. So clearly that was out. I was acting station manager and had done the interview, so it was very nerve-wracking stuff for me. And this is a completely unknown story, actually, or largely unknown. And I've later confronted I.F. Stones about this story, and he claimed to have no recollection whatsoever. But there were people there. I.F. Stone called me first and said, this is a fabulous interview. I'm going to devote my whole next issue of I.F. Stone's Weekly to it. I love it. And it was the one kind of ray of light in what otherwise was a whole series of warnings about don't go ahead with this. Jerry Shore, who had been hired as executive vice president in charge of running the stations, came to New York to be with us during the broadcast so that he had nothing to do with the broadcast whatsoever. He was based in California. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had been consulted, but we rarely consulted people. We were young lions and mm-hmm. went off yeah. on our own. But he did come to be with us when
that's the why so much good stuff got done.
That's why so, exactly. Very light-fingered management. I mean, we didn't view it that way at the time, but in hindsight, my God, what they let us do was unbelievable. So Jerry came to be with us in the broadcast, and we were sitting in my office as acting station manager, and I.F. Stone called, and he said, I want to speak with Mr. Koch. And I said, Izzy, what's going on? He said, Mr. Koch, I want to say that I've reread the transcript carefully, and I want to publicly disassociate myself with it. I'm not going to devote any time in the I.F. Stone's Weekly to it, and I just want to publicly disassociate myself. So I said, Izzy, we're in a private phone conversation. What are you talking about publicly disassociating yourself? He said, well, that's it. He hung up. I went white. I was just ash, and I suddenly thought, my God, am I totally wrong on this? I must have totally screwed up. Jerry could see. He said, he said, let's get out of here. This is like an hour, 2 hours before the broadcast for that night. Went out and I had a martini at the bar next door. I had a couple of drinks, actually, to calm down. I was really nervous. But we went ahead with we said, we know we got it right. We went ahead with the broadcast, and we did it. And very shortly thereafter, we were subpoenaed by the Senate Internal Security mm-hmm. Subcommittee. No one really doubted that it wasn't vindictive on Hoover's part. But the strange thing was that a careful investigation of Pacifica, I think, probably turned up a lot of controversial programming, but there was, mm-hmm. Pacifica was not an organization that was at all enamored with the Communist Party. Oh, Elsa was very left and very liberal, but profoundly anti-communist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, she mm-hmm. refused to return to Poland with a lover or husband, I think a lover after the war, because Poland had gone communist mm-hmm. and she didn't want to live in a communist state. So she was very mm-hmm. strongly anti-communist. So that really, in the investigation that HUAC did, there was really nothing they could find.
Yeah. In those days.
Except that Jerry Shore had probably been a member of the Communist Party. Certainly his wife had been a member of the Communist Party. This was not mm-hmm. You know, but Jerry had long decided not to. He didn't want to implicate his wife. He didn't want to get involved. It was such a peripheral, esoteric relationship. You know, I mean, he was hardly like a spy, or I mean, it was just. But he was. He did have this little touch of this little taint of pink. You know,
and do you know how long before?
Oh, I think it must. I think you know, 20 years. I mean, I can't believe that Jerry would have remained. I mean, I don't know if he was ever really active. But I think he did have some tangential relationship that could be pointed to. But in those hysterical times, it was, you know, it was enough. And at the same time that was going on, you're right. And I had, you know, is that the renewal of Pacifica's license was up before the FCC. And we all felt, our experience at Pacifica had been, those of us who were, I mean, Elsa and Down, we all had found that controversy had really led to the growth and empowerment of the stations. That when we did a controversial broadcast, if we then got attacked, that would bring out supporters and defenders and money to help. So that we were never controversy, strangely enough, we worked to, because we were not advertising based and there was nobody who was going to pull out revenues because, oh my God, we've got to avoid controversy. Our subscribers liked controversy. That's kind of why they listened to us, and controversy would increase their financial commitments to the station. So we had been trained over a period of three or four years here to see controversy as leading to economic stability and growth. I mean, it's the opposite of a commercial operation. But, and I was not privy to the higher councils of the board at that point, but we, of course, we loved Jerry. I mean, Jerry was the first, in the 3 years that I had been there at that point, Jerry was the first person we'd had at a national level who kind of got the then three stations working together as a unit.
He thought as a broadcaster rather than as an administrator.
He did. He thought of he was very good with the troops, and he was just very supportive, and you know, he was very helpful. He was always there when you needed him. He was on the phone. He was decisive. He knew how to spend money. He didn't waste it. And we had the other people who had been involved, you know, I mean, God bless their hearts, in hindsight particularly, you know, what they had, you know, like, they just didn't seem to have that kind of, they always seemed a little bit more befuddled and a little more confused and didn't quite know what to do, and they were, you know, they were very sweet people, but they just didn't see, they didn't have his effectiveness. So we felt that Jerry was not only we feel it was wrong for him to be asked to resign or to be put in a position where he felt he should resign, which I guess is the fairest way to put it.
Quaker way to go about it.
And the proper Quaker way to go about it, yeah. Not only did we feel that that was morally wrong, but we really felt that we were losing a good administrator and a good executive. The foundation was going to be hurt by it. And but he did resign. He was convinced to resign, or he agreed to resign. He did resign. And as a result of his resignation, the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee hearings went no further, and Pacifica's license was renewed. And but a certain kind of innocence was lost, I think, at that point.
One sacrificial lamb was necessary for that.
Yeah, a certain innocence was lost at that point. I think that the staff never really quite trusted management again for some time, and I think that led later to really quite serious consequences in terms of, you know, a whole kind of change in programming thrust. But that didn't happen for a while.
Yeah, it integrity doesn't get lost all at once.
No, unlike virginity.
Yeah, now I want to leap forward in time, as they say, to when you went off to North Vietnam and did...
I don't know if you want to hear about. I mean, we had.
That's exactly what I want to hear about.
By this time, this was 65. I had done. We had. Pacifica got heavily involved in covering the civil rights movement. Always had been from the beginning. And when Freedom Summer came along in the summer of 65, 64.
64 is going to be
in the summer of 64. Dale and I went. In fact,
That's right. You were with Dale down in the South for that coverage.
Dale went down to Birmingham and did the Birmingham. Then we actually produced that together. And as you point out in your monograph, that was the American entering the Grand Prix Italian. It should have won. except some Dutch sailing show won, as I remember. But that's all right. Then the kids disappeared in Philadelphia. Dale and I were on a plane. As soon as we heard they disappeared, Dale and I got on a plane. We were in Philadelphia the next morning. In fact, we went out to the church together. We rented a car. We went out to the church together that had been burned down. We got out of the car. We were walking around the ruins of the church. It was way on a remote dirt road outside of Philadelphia in real rural Mississippi. And suddenly a car pulls up into the driveway behind our car, maybe 20 yards from it. And out of the car get four guys or five guys with clubs. I mean, big guys with clubs. And Dale and I ran to the car. Dale jumped in the driver's seat. I jumped on the other side. We got the car started, roared out of the driveway, and we came to this rural road. And Dale said, left or right? And we had come from the right, and I was worried that they would have blocked the road. I said, let's go left. Dale said, I think we better go back the way we know and turn right. We hightailed it back to Philadelphia, which was maybe 15 miles away, 10, 12 miles away, hearts in our throat, because this was a road that you easily could have blocked because there were great steep irrigation ditches on both sides. So one car would have blocked the road, and we would have been in fairly serious trouble.
You would have got to North Vietnam.
I don't think so, no. This is a long way to get to North Vietnam. But anyway, so we had, and we went on then to, I went on to, Dale went back, I went on to spend the summer in Mississippi, and we covered the civil rights movement. I thought that was 65, which is why I told that story, but so we were very involved in that movement, and we began getting funds for that kind of coverage from things like Women's Strike for Peace and other progressive or liberal organizations. In 65, there was a World Peace Congress in Helsinki, Finland, in the summer. I think May or June. Yep. And I got a small grant to go cover the World Peace Congress from Women's Strike for Peace. So I kind of went with their delegation. And my main interest was the emerging war in Southeast Asia, which, in fact, one of the first documentaries Pacifica had done was in 62 on Southeast Asia. I think it was called Don't Louse Me Up or some such. Maybe that was just what we called it, walking around the station. So we had been interested, and I went to the North Vietnam. I was interested in talking to the North Vietnam.
Scott Keach was around in news at that time, wasn't he?
Right. Yeah. I was interested in the North Vietnamese delegation, about which America knew almost nothing about North Vietnam. We had not had any official presence in that country since 1954, when the French pulled out. So what we knew was either from spies or from other people. The French knew a great deal more than we did. And at the World Peace Congress in May, I made contact with I talked to the North Vietnamese delegation, and they, of course, gave it. At this point in the United States, the portraits of North Vietnam were extremely grim. I think you can go back and find issues of Time magazine where they say that economic conditions are so bad that Ho Chi Minh has ordered that field workers only have to work a half day because they simply don't have the stamina to work a full day in the fields. This was the kind of attitude that we had toward Vietnam, North Vietnam, all of which I think was designed unconsciously to convince Americans that it would be pretty easy to beat them.
Walkover.
It would be a walkover, exactly. But we didn't really know, and so I went and talked to the North Vietnamese, and of course it was described, this is a definite quote from Time, as the most brutal of the brutal totalitarian states, communist states. It was both portrayed as being weak and portrayed as being particularly, horrible for its citizens and on the brink of disaster in every way. Well, of course, these guys said, everybody loves Ho Chi Minh. We have he's very popular. It's a popular. These are communist government agents. So what else would they say? But food is in good supply. We don't have any trouble resupplying the South. And I said, well, if things are so good, why don't you let American reporters in to see for themselves? Because it had been closed. And they said, well, would you like to come? And I said, yeah, I'd love to come. Seeing myself as kind of being Edgar Snow, I thought, oh boy, this is great. So I came back to Washington and never heard another thing about them until very late that summer. When I got a telegram from Paris saying, completely no signature, just a telegram saying, be at number 6 Rue de Venus on September 11th, or whatever day it was. And I knew that I mean, I just knew. I mean, I knew no signature, but I knew that it was.
And you were in. Where were you?
I was in New York.
And you were in New York at this point. And be in Paris.
Be in Paris. Right. Number six, Rue de Venise. And such and such a date. So I thought, I got to do this. This is too. So I went in and I borrowed money from a lawyer friend of mine. And he was so. He's the only person I told. I told my wife and this lawyer. I didn't tell anybody else. The lawyer was so nervous that he made me. The money was exchanged in the men's room on two floors below his. He had offices on 42nd Street and right off Fifth Avenue. And he wouldn't even talk to me until we went down two stories in his building and went into a men's room two stories below, and that's where we discussed what I was doing and where I was going, and he gave me a large amount of cash that would carry, you know, that would take care of me for that part of the trip. So with that in hand, and not telling Pacifica...
Nowadays, you couldn't get into a men's room for the sexual activity.
That's right. No, we would have been accused of being gay brothers. And it would have been locked. We couldn't have got in because there would have been a key that you had to get from. But these were simpler days. And so I did. I went to number 6 Rue de Venise in Paris on the appointed day and met there four other young men, three other young men, and a Canadian, Richard Ward, I think his name was, Dick Ward. Two Americans, Harold Supriano, an African-American, and Mike Meyerson, who wrote a book about the trip, which is pretty accurate. Mm-hmm. Mike Myers wrote a book about the trip. And Mike Myers.
Oh, right. Do you remember the title, just to get it onto the
record? I do not
record.
Remember the title, but Mike has written not very many books, I mean, I don't think. And it's easy to find. I don't remember what it was called, though. I had it for years, but I don't have it anymore.
Right. Okay. Well, that's
and
possible to get.
We had some negotiations about my status as whether I'd be part of the delegation. I insisted on being attached to the delegation as a journalist, which was just because I didn't want to go as a member of... I didn't want to go as a member of a delegation. I wanted to go as a journalist. I mean, that was important to me. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Made final agreements and took off. And we flew through the Soviet Union. The Vietnamese said, "Now, I want you to tell our Soviet comrades that you're going to Peking. Don't tell them your final destination. Regrettably, our Chinese comrades need to know more about your destination than our Soviet comrades." So we flew to Peking. Spent 3 days in Peking waiting for a flight, and then flew from Peking to Nanking, and then from Nanking across the border into Hanoi. And spent about a week in Hanoi itself, and then spent about a week traveling to what they called the front, which in those days was just beyond the Hamrong River Bridge, down toward South Vietnam, about, I don't know, 30, 40 miles out of the capital, maybe a little further. Because we were just beginning our, you know, we hadn't bombed Hanoi yet. We were bombing the periphery. It was the beginning of what I think Kissinger referred to as closing the noose around North Vietnam. And
he liked metaphors like that.
He did, yes. And the trip really, it had as powerful an impact on me as going to Mississippi in 1964 had, and that is in seeing what I had just read about, and several things became very clear from the trip. One is that, you know, whatever people may have secretly felt about Ho Chi Minh and the government, they were publicly extremely enthusiastic about Ho Chi Minh. And if you looked at a little bit of their history, you kind of thought, well, you know, this makes a certain amount of sense because he had freed them from colonialism and he had modeled his Declaration of Independence and his Constitution on the American, because OSS officers from the United States and France had flown into Vietnam and worked with him, so he knew. I mean, he was a respecter of the United States. And two, you could tell that people were not. People did not look starved and depressed. I mean, the country in the daytime was abandoned, but at night it was swarming with people because they did everything at night under the cover of darkness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then coming back, I began to read. We came back and we held a press conference. I was interviewed by...
And you were doing a lot of interviews while you were over there.
We did a lot of interviews. It was difficult to do interviews on tape. We talked to Premier Phan Van Dung. We couldn't interview him on tape. We talked to other people, and there was a language problem. We did do some recording, but a lot of what we did was take notes and use, you know, and use those for writing a script later. It was kind of old-fashioned reporting. When we came back, we held a press conference, the four of us, and then I was interviewed by NBC, CBS, ABC, and PBS, but not one word of the interviews ever ran on any station, and I called.
Including PBS.
Including PBS. And Bob Potts, who had been my news and news director at BAI, was now news director at WNET in New York, and he interviewed me for, was not McNeil Lehrer, but the precursor to McNeil Lehrer, the PBS newscast, never got on the air. And I called Bob and I said, why didn't this get on the air, Bob? And he thought it was getting, he said, well, you know, it just is, you know, frankly, it was killed, you know. I mean, I wanted it on, but it was killed. It was killed by everyone.
Not so much an interview as a debriefing.
It was quite extraordinary to me that nobody wanted to, you know, that I mean, people could have made fun of me or disagreed with me, but they didn't want it. They didn't want to hear it at all. I had, during this period, I had continued to do a great deal of research on things like the French knew an enormous amount about Vietnam, and if you read the French press at all carefully, you could have, anybody who had read the French press carefully could have predicted the outcome of the Vietnam War for America. I mean, that's, there's just no question about that. That, reading the French press in conjunction with going there and meeting the Vietnamese was very convincing. And this is basically what I'd said to people. I said, you know, we're in deep trouble over there. We're not going to win this war, guys. Let me tell you about the Vietnamese. This is a little nation that has fought China for 2,000 years. They have beat the Chinese every time, because if it takes them 20 years, they keep fighting. You know, we don't have this. We're not next door. We're not as powerful as China vis-a-vis them because we have these long supply routes. We don't have the staying power. You know, we're going to leave one day. They're going to win, and we can't beat them. That's number one. Number two, the bombing is not having the desired effect. And then all you have to do is go to the literature, what you find out, this is literature from World War II, American literature from World War II. What you find out is, when you look at the literature of bombing, is number one, Germany reached the height of its productive capacity in 1945, after 5 years of heavy bombardment. They were producing more guns, more airplanes, more tanks, more ammunition in 1945 than at any time during the war. So bombing does not interrupt productivity. Mm-hmm. You know, what bombing does do, what it did do for the Germans, the Germans could not get the stuff from the factories to the front lines because it was very good at interdicting the German sophisticated communications and transportation system, railroads and autobahns.
And I think
But the Vietnamese didn't move stuff like that. The Vietnamese moved stuff on bicycles and elephants, and bombing just doesn't, it's real ineffective to go after a bicycle with a B-52.
Yeah. Well, I think the British realized this towards the end of the war, and it was one of the reasons, the unstated reasons, why they went over to morale bombings and the wiping out of cities if you can't get their munitions, you know, get their spirit.
Sure. But again, if you read studies of bombing, as I did at the time, and I think they would still plan, bombing does not tend to separate the civilian population from the government, no matter how bad it is. Mm. Bombing tends to cement, no matter how bad the government, people tend, it's the only thing they can cling to. Nobody else is going to warn them. Nobody else is going to put them in shelters. So that bombing is counter-effective both in terms of productivity, not effective in terms of transportation and distribution of goods, and is counter-effective in terms of morale. So the bombing campaign is a failure.
But it's great for the munitions industry.
It's wonderful for the musicians. And it probably makes people feel good to see all that stuff blowing up too. I mean, I think the country at war thing, oh my God, how can we lose? Dale, at the time I went to North Vietnam, or shortly thereafter, Dale Miner, who was my very closest friend in those days, you know, went to South Vietnam. And we came together when I got back from North Vietnam, and we met each other sometime during that year. And I said, Dale, we're going to lose the war. And I told him these reasons. And Dale said, Chris, if you were in South Vietnam, you'd realize we can't lose because our technology is so sophisticated. You know, it's going to overwhelm them. And I said, Dale, it's not about technology. And that was a huge battle. And of course, in a certain sense, it was a battle in America at the time, you know, between is it technology or is it. And I was quite convinced at the time that I was right. And I proved to have been right, but, you know, I don't.
But it was a battle between two equally plausible scenarios.
It was. It was two equally plausible military scenarios, you know, as. And certainly, you know, I don't know if certainly, technology was overwhelming in the Gulf War, but I'm not sure, I don't think that was a parallel situation, because I think that
Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam. North Vietnam was a very different country than Iraq and Saddam Hussein, although those comparisons probably would be made by some people. I don't believe that myself.
That'd be made by good capitalists, but that's
now,
not
in terms
the whole
of Pacifica, I came back. I had not talked to Pacifica before I went. I came back, I held the press conference, and I told Pacifica at that point that I was back, and they were quite upset with my having gone. This, of course, is on the heels of a number of
Were you
of other
on the staff at Pacifica at
I was
that
program,
time.
Acting program director. Yeah. No, I was program director and acting station manager.
Yeah, so you held that position at the time that you went over
that's
to
correct.
North Carolina.
And I got back and I did prepared a series of radio broadcasts. I think, as I remember, there were six or seven of them, and I can't even listen to them today. They're very tedious and somewhat, I was so serious, you know. Anyway, I did these, and they were mainly scripted, very few interviews, a little bit of music, and Pacifica wanted to see them before they went on the air. Chris Albertson might have become, I think Chris Albertson was station manager by then. I think Chris might have been there. Mm-hmm. I'm quite sure Chris Albertson was station manager.
Do you have copies of this, any of this material still?
I could probably dig it out, yeah. It's in the Pacific Archives, too, I think. Mm-hmm. Chris Albertson was station manager by that time, but I was still program director. And Chris, I'm sure at the behest of the Pacifica board, insisted on seeing the broadcast. I think Halleck Hoffman might have been involved with this in some way. So I gave them a copy of the broadcast, and they came back, and they wanted a number of changes in my script, 30 or 40 changes in the script. And I sat down and went over them all, and I convinced them on all but 10 that these were not statements of opinion, but statements of fact, and they could stay in. But there were 10 remaining points they wanted changed, and I said, listen, I'm your program director. If you don't have faith in my judgment on these issues, then how can I continue to serve as a program director, judging other people's work that goes on the air? I think you've put me in an untenable position. And they said, well, we're not going to broadcast these unless you make these changes. And I said, well, if you're not going to broadcast, a work of your program director, then, I can't stay. And so I resigned at that point. As soon as I resigned, they broadcast the programs with no changes and broadcast them over and 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 over again. It was classic.
Oh,
it was wonderful.
That is Pacifica. So down the line.
I then spent a year lecturing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cut off your prick and then serve it up as sausage.
Exactly. Yeah. But, it was probably time for me to go. I mean, in hindsight, at the time I was pretty... I don't know. It was not a bad thing, as it turned out, for me.
Yeah. Well, it's such a... it drained so much energy, that place. You had to bring resources into it. Oh. It was very difficult to draw resources from it.
Well, all this stuff takes place, of course, during, endless hours of conversation and phone calls and drinks in bars and, on into the night. I mean, no, Pacifica was a 24-hour commitment. I mean, you slept, but that was it. I mean...
How Elsa survived all those years?
Elsa was a phenomenon. Elsa had more staying power than I did. I mean, she, I'm sure she would have... advised me to make my 10 changes and stay. I don't know what she said. I forget. Mm-hmm. She did interview me at great length and ran that. I mean, what I had to say got out in Pacifica, which is to its credit. I mean, they didn't, they broadcast what I had to say and certainly used it to raise a lot of money over the years, for a while. But they did need another sacrificial lamb.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yes, Elsa was...
This was a time, John, you have to remember that this was a time when the network still ran every new employee's name by government people in Washington. I mean, it's not well known, but this I would love to check this sometime in the Freedom of Information Act. This is a very brief story. I don't want to waste your time because it's not directly...
You're not wasting any time.
But I was... Because of my trip to North Vietnam, I was called, and because then I left, I was called by CBS and I was in the New York Times, and I wrote a lot about the trip. I had articles in Diplomat magazine, and I mean, Newsweek had a spread on me. I had photographs in Life magazine. I had many pages. I had like 3 issues of the Denver Post. I had mentioned Diplomat. I had a whole issue of I.F. Stone's Weekly. I mean, I had a lot of press coverage, so I was kind of in the news, and... And I think because of the trip, CBS called me, Sandy Sokolow first, and then Gordon Manning, and interviewed me about a job on air covering the congressional elections in, God, this sounds unlikely, but covering the congressional elections in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont in the 1966 election, a job which I think later went to Mike Wallace. I talked to Sandy and then Gordon Manning and several meetings with Gordon, and then just before Christmas of 65, Gordon called me into his office and said, well, congratulations, Chris, you're on board. We're, you know, CBS is pleased to have you as an employee, and you'll love this. We think you'll be great. And I said, gee, I'm really thrilled, and when do I start? Well, after the first of the year, we'll call you. And I was walking out of his office, and he had his arm around my shoulder. I didn't forget his office. He had like this huge giant portrait of his kids on the wall. It was a very fancy office. And I said, Gordon, the only question, we didn't discuss salary. And he said, Chris, at the level you're coming into CBS, I wouldn't worry about salary, was his comment, quote. So Christmas holidays come and go. The first of the year come and go. No call from Gordon Manning. No call. I'd be around the end of the first week of January. Mm-hmm. I call, I'm sorry, Mr. Manning's out of town. He's unavailable, No, Mr. Sokolow can't return your call. I'll give him your message. No, totally iced. So it's maybe early February, and I'm telling this story at a synagogue on Long Island where I'm giving a lecture on the Vietnam War, because I was supporting myself now by lecturing. $50 a lecture. I'd sometimes do 3 or 4 lectures a day. Boys' schools, girls' schools, yeah, colleges, synagogues, mm-hmm, churches, Unitarian. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm really working hard.
It sounds like Mart Saul after he got blacklisted and went out to the colleges.
That's what you do. Thank God for the American colleges, So I told this story about CBS, and at the end of it, one of the members of the congregation came up and said, I have a relationship. I'm a lawyer, and I have a relationship with CBS News and their legal staff. Do you want me to find out what happened? And I said, yes, I really would. And you don't take notes in these days. I would today, but I'm old today. I was young then. I wish I had this guy's name. He called me about 2 weeks later. I was very surprised. Maybe a week later, he called me and says, I talked to CBS. You were hired. Gordon Manning, you had the job. CBS sends every name to what they refer to in the organization as their attorneys in Washington for a final clearance of okay. And the attorney in Washington called back and said, you cannot hire this guy. This guy, you do not want this. You cannot hire this person because of his political background. Now, I've never checked that with the Freedom of Information Act, but I tell you, I am extremely sure that this is the case. Sandy Sokolow, about a month later in April, or maybe March or April, called me and said, Chris, can I meet you for a drink? And I said, sure. And I went to the Slate, which is where CBS drank in those days, and Sandy's sitting in a booth, and he says, listen, Chris, we want to get a reporter into North Vietnam. We thought maybe you could be helpful. And I said, Sandy, I'd love to. I'll go. Well, that's not really going to be possible, Chris. We need to get one of our own guys in. And I said, well, I'll produce him. Well, we really don't want you to produce him either. That's not really possible. I said, Sandy, you're about to hire me, And he said, well, other priorities came along. It had nothing to do, of course, with you. I mean, you think you're terrific, but we did have some other things. And, that's the way these things work sometimes. And I said, yeah, that's true. I said, listen, if you were so high on me and thought I was so good, would you recommend me to some of your colleagues at NBC or ABC? And he looked at me and he says, you ever thought about going into another profession? I said, oh. So I have to believe that networks vetted their employees through the FBI in those days. Up until I bet you it didn't last much longer than that. I bet you up through that period of time that every name that before they hired went down and got checked.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has happened for years in Britain with BBC and MI5, and it's just starting to come out now.
Right. Well, it's an interesting. I mean, I'd love to look into that sometime. But anyway,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I'd actually like to ask you a bit about what you've been doing since.
I'll give you a 2-minute update.
CV.
I'll give you a 2-minute CV. After lecturing for close to a year, I took a job as a teacher at Bennington College, teaching American literature and the British novel, which I had gotten a master's degree in college.
Oh my God!
So I taught for 2 years at Bennington, which was safe, mm-hmm. And then I left Bennington and returned actually to broadcasting. I went to KPFK in Los Angeles and spent a year as public affairs director, and I did a live radio show called Free Lunch, which ran from 11 o'clock in the morning till I think 1 or 2 in the afternoon. But Pacifica, it wasn't a love affair anymore. I mean, I didn't like my station manager very much. LA is a very hard town to be poor in. Mm-hmm. And you have to be poor if you want to work for Pacifica, which is actually not that bad.
Who was the station manager at that time?
Marvin Siegelman. Uh-huh, right. And Phil Watson was his assistant, who's now actually here at KPF, at WPFW. I just didn't have I enjoyed doing the live radio show, but nothing else appealed to me very much anymore. And then I went to San Francisco and got a job at KQED in television production. Mm. I was hired for their tape unit because none of their filmmakers would work in tape. And they said, well, you're in radio, that's tape, so why don't you go to work for our tape unit? I said, well, that makes sense to me. So I went out with some of those first ENG portable units, big 2-inch videotape units in a Samsonite sack that weighed about 80 pounds. You went out and you could take like 2 minutes of film, 2 minutes of taping with them. It was unbelievable. So I did that in KQED for a while. But KQED would not let me do, because of my political background, KQED would not let me do...
Not let you on the air.
They wouldn't let me do political programming of any kind. Oh. They said, we'll hire you, but you can only do culture. You cannot do anything political because of your political past. So I did cultural programming.
Culture's safe.
But guess what? Guess what was going on culturally in 1969, 70, 71? Mm-hmm. The counterculture. So, of course, once again, I throw myself into the counterculture. I'm up at Wheeler's Commune doing a piece. I do a piece called The Fine Art of Goofing Off, which is a wonderful series. I mean, but so whimsical. I mean, you look at it today, you wonder, how did this ever run on American television? John Leonard gave it a wonderful review. He said, Chris Koch, who used to be somewhat serious, is now in Life Magazine, this is a review in Life, seems to have joined the psychedelic set in California. But it was a very psychedelic show. It was very... very kind of, counterculture-ish. Mm-hmm. And I had let my hair grow long by then, and I had let my beard grow, and finally in 72, the Vietnam War was the country was in a lot of Americans were dropping out at that point, young Americans, kind of because they had kind of given up with any hope of changing the system, and then the notion became... one of the basic notions of the counterculture was that was expressed in a piece of graffiti I saw in a men's room, actually, at a coffee. I think, what the hell was that coffee place in North Beach I used to go to? But
Vesuvio's?
Vesuvio's, yeah, Vesuvio's, which was off the pig inside before you off the pig on the street. Which was basically saying, change your... I mean, there are two basic strategies to change the world, right? And one is you go out and change other people. Mm-hmm. And the other one is you change yourself. I mean, there are probably lots of other ways, but those kind of all, falls into those two categories. Mm-hmm. And the counterculture was all about changing yourself.
It's not a subject I hear discussed very much these days.
No, we're not into changing ourselves. We're into changing others. We're back into that. But, well, anyway, so I actually went and lived in northern New Mexico for 3.5 years, south of Taos. In a beautiful mountain valley. I could lean on my front porch and look one direction and look up Jicarita, which was a 13,000-foot mountain that went into the valley. And if I really hustled, I could be on top of it by around in time for a late lunch. And I could lean the other way on my porch and look across maybe 4 mountain ranges into Arizona, looking westward. I mean, it was a beautiful spot, 8,000 feet in the mountains. And I lived there for 3.5 years and then found it difficult to make a living. And had written a book, a part of a novel, which I thought I might try to sell in New York. And I came back to New York to try to sell the novel. And I loved New Mexico. I loved living in the country. I never was bothered by the physical work. I didn't mind doing working class jobs to make a living. Mm-hmm. I liked the animals. I liked everything about it, but I missed broadcasting. I really missed my profession. So one thing I think I've really... It's one of the few things I've really done well
You know, I mean, I really...
It's
I mean,
an
I'm
art
really
form that one can
it,
become
you know?
As much involved with as painting or sculpture
Absolutely,
or anything else.
Absolutely, you know, and I began to realize that really it was a craft, you know. Yeah. And that's what I've come in my... At this stage of my life, I really view it in its highest form as a craft. And I also think that being a craftsman is the highest calling that a human being can do. I like it a lot. I like the thought of it a lot. Arthur Miller wrote a play, The Last Yankee, which is I saw in London and didn't think was terribly good, but it stuck in my mind. And I think that he was trying to say that you know, the older traditional America was an America based on craft, on the honoring of craft as a way of life, not just as a something to do to make a living, but as a way of life. So I missed that craft, and it took me 2 years to get it back into broadcasting in New York, almost 2 years, about a year and a half. I still had long hair and I had a beard. Nobody would hire me. I had an earring, I think. Nobody would hire me. I took the earring out. I cut my hair shorter. I shaved my beard off. They still wouldn't hire me. So I drove a cab in New York for a year. This is in my 40s. So I drove a taxi for a year. That was kind of interesting. And one day I was walking up Madison Avenue, and I was wondering, why does everyone care about how long my hair is? Why is everyone so hung up on the length of my hair? What does that have to do with anything? And I said, why do I care about how long my hair is? And I walked right into a barbershop on Madison Avenue. I said, want a business haircut? Guy was thrilled. You know, cut the whole thing up. His
head. Yeah, John, exactly. John, Ollie North special.
John, I had a job in 2 months. Yeah, I had a job. Six weeks later, I had a job. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Carrie McMillions, once again, the guy who had sent me on my death route into decline. Not really, no. His wife was Marlene Sanders. Jerry Toobin. That's right. Carrie McWilliams sent me to Jerry Toobin at NET. Mm-hmm. And Jerry Toobin was like public affairs director, and he didn't have a job for me, he said. But his wife was Marlene Sanders, and Marlene Sanders ran the documentary unit Close-Up at ABC News. And I went in and talked to Marlene, and we happened to click. And she didn't ask any political questions about me at all. She just liked me, and she hired me at the lowest entry-level job. I made less working for her than I did make driving a cab. I was making about $25,000 driving a cab. She hired me for $17,000. This is like 73 or 74. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was very low. But I took it, and within a year I was, you know, producing. I mean, she realized that I wasn't, you know, I mean, I had a meteoric rise, I guess. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, this is an interesting anecdote. You want a little anecdote here? This is an interesting little look at American journalism. The ABC career ended after I co-produced a show called The All-American Army, A Shocking State of Readiness, which we did for Marlene. Mm-hmm. And basically the show that we produced was a look at the American Army in 1973 through the eyes of the sergeants of the Army. And the sergeants are the people who really run the Army. I mean, the officers come and go, the sergeants. So we felt this was a valid way to look at the Army. And what we found was an Army that was riddled with racism, torn apart by drug and alcohol abuse, and the schism between the druggies and the alkies, you know, which was a generational thing as well. An officer class that, on the view of the sergeants and us, the program, was lazy and kind of uncaring, and as a result of that laziness and lack of care, units in the what potentially could be the front lines, their tanks didn't work, their rifles didn't fire. I mean, it was like the Army was in a bad spot. And the center of the film, the kind of the epiphany of the film, was this white officer out of West Point training troops at Fort Jackson, and behind him are a whole bunch of Hispanic and African American troops, and at one point he gestures and he says, see these guys, they're losers, they were born losers, they're going to die losers, and you can't make an army out of losers. And it was like you heard that in our cut and you said, oh my God, that's what's wrong with the Army. I mean, there it is in a nutshell. That was kind of like the, all right. So we turned it into Marlene before Christmas. I think 73. It might have been 74. I think 73. And Marlene said, great, great show. It'll go on the air and da-da-da. Well, meantime, Marlene was in a power struggle. Rune didn't like Marlene, Rune Arledge, who had taken over the news from the sports division. And Rune was courting Pam Hill, who was a very successful producer in terms of getting very high ratings. And Pam had been made creative consultant, or creative director of the unit, and Pam was executive producer, I mean, and Marlene was executive producer. But Rune would never talk to Pam. Rune would never talk to Marlene. So he would only talk to Pam. So Marlene was in an untenable position of trying to run a department without, you know. And so over Christmas, she resigned. And Pam, the first thing Pam did, she said, I want to screen your film. So she screened the film in January. And she said, this is the biggest piece of junk I've ever seen. This is totally a disaster. I mean, this is lousy. I hate it. It's got to be completely redone. She took my producer, an African-American, off the show entirely. Put me in charge of it, sent me back to Europe to interview a whole bunch of former Nazi generals about the threat from the Soviet Union. The show was rewritten 17 times, by five or six times by me, two or three times by Tony Batten, two or three times by the correspondent. Finally, Marlene took it over and wrote it herself. And at the end, the show said exactly the opposite of what the guy who gestures had become the spokesman for the film. And the whole thing was a dump on the quality of the recruits that they were getting in the Army. The whole problem with the Army became a problem with the recruits who they were bringing into the Army. That was the problem. It was the low level, the low educational level, the low moral level of the African, largely, I mean, they were talking about the African-American, Hispanic troops.
Yeah.
And the poor whites who were brought in, that was what was wrong with the Army. And so he became the spokesman. You can't make an army out of losers. These people are all losers. They always will be. Well, before a show goes in the air, you have a final screening with the lawyers. And I was sitting in the screening room, and the lawyers are there, and Tony's there, and Tony Batten, who is the producer, you know, he's just, I mean, he's totally, you know, he's slouched down in his chair with his eyes closed, you know. And I lean over to Dick Richter, who was Pam's assistant, and I said to Dick, and what I thought was, I said, you know, this show says exactly the opposite of what we found in the field. And Pam overheard me and turned to me and with a big smile on her face and said, isn't it funny how things turn out that way sometimes? So I said, well, I can't do this for a living. So I resigned from, so I left, I quit the close-up unit and came to Washington where we launched.
Pacifica spoils you. You get used to being honest.
Yeah, Pacifica spoiled me. Where I went on the air with a show called FYI, strangely enough, just like Murphy Brown, but of course it wasn't like Murphy Brown. And it was me, this black producer, Tony Batten, and an Asian girl doing news. It was the Mod Squad of news. This is like 74 or so. But John, when I came to WETA for a job, the then station manager called me into his office before they hired me and said, Chris, I just have to ask you one question. I mean, I just want this is completely off the record. I got to ask you one question. I said, what's that? He said, are you still political? This is 1974, you know. Getting a job, he said, are you still political? And I said, I'm not political anymore. I'm not totally not political. I'm only a journalist. That's all I am. He said, okay, I just had to ask. He said, you know, because, you know, I just had to ask you about that. So that stuff doesn't, you know, that stayed around a long, long time.
Mm. Yeah. Well, what about now?
I did.
What I mean, that question about being political.
Well, I think it's. I think it's looser. I think it's looser now. I don't think it's better because it's looser. Because I think other things have happened that make it. I mean, I think that. What's happened to my? I don't call myself a journalist anymore. I stopped calling myself a journalist 5 years ago because I am so appalled by the craft of journalism. I now call myself a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't want to be associated. I think the press is in desperately bad shape. I mean, I think it's never. I think it's worse than it was during the conformist period of the 50s. Honestly, I mean, I really do. I think it's wrong. It's bad for different. It's not bad because it keeps out progressives, you know, or because it keeps out people who are beyond the pale or considered to be beyond the pale. It's bad because of its pandering to the lowest common denominator of making money. I mean, that's why it's bad.
Yeah.
And so people make decisions, you know.
The things I've seen happen to The Guardian over the last few years.
That's probably a gem compared to what's going on.
Oh, it is.
Here,
yeah. It's a fine paper. But now there is a good paper inside of The Guardian. And you have to know who to read.
Yeah.
And what to tear up and throw away.
Yeah. So.
Now, you must have something in the way of publicity material about your handout sometimes, about your TV operation and what you do.
We do. I can tell you, let me just, I'll quickly go through the rest of this. One or 2 years at WETA, and then National Public Radio called me and asked me if I would produce All Things Considered. And I did. I produced All Things Considered for 2 years, and then spent a third year with National Public Radio doing a television version of ATC. And the producing the daily radio show was really fun. It was like Pacifica again. I mean, it really was fun. Deciding how to cover the news on a daily basis was a joy. And I was very fortunate. I think I always have been. I was very fortunate to have gotten the job at a time when my bosses were launching another major radio program, Morning Edition. As a consequence of that, they left me totally alone. They ignored me. They took all my staff, put it into the morning show. I had to hire my own people, which I thought was a tragedy, but then turned out to be, of course, a blessing.
Yeah.
I hired my own staff, so almost everyone was loyal to me, and we did just what we wanted. I mean, it was, and we were referred to as the Pacifica Mafia, incidentally. I mean, we would not be loved by some because we went too far. I mean, and again, what got me in trouble at NPR was, I mean, I let the word motherfucker appear in the air once in a poem by a black American. That got me in a great deal of trouble. And when Reagan was, there was an assassination attempt against Reagan. We were in the second half hour of ATC. We devoted the entire half hour to reactions to the assassination. And we had read on the AP wire, and we had read and we know from our reporters who are around the country that in many places throughout America, blacks got up and cheered when they heard that Reagan had been shot. In classrooms, kids got up and cheered. We put on one report from one woman, 15 seconds long, where this woman said, they should have shot him, you know, he deserved it. You know, he hasn't done anything for the people of this country, you know, I don't care that he got shot, or something like that. We had the Secret Service in our office within 15 minutes. I was called on the carpet by, you know, I mean, the people were real upset about that 10 or 15 second clip. So once again, you know, I think I've always kind of liked to push things to the limits.
Yeah, but nowadays there are radio stations in New York talk-in programs where blacks phone in and with you know, violent anti-Semitism and anything seems to go within that ghetto.
But see, not on National Public Radio. I mean, that was, you know, that's it was a public system, government funded, and I defended to the death the 15-second clip from the woman who, because I think that was, I mean, as I said when I was called up on it, you know, our job is not to make the news. Our job is to report the news. Mm-hmm. And there is certainly out of 30 minutes, there's, you know, there is 15 seconds worth of that sentiment in America, and people ought to know about it, because otherwise you're just your head's in your sand. My job's not to decide, you know, I can't filter that out. That's got to be known. I think I was wrong with the motherfucker. I mean, I think that was an error of judgment on my part. I think that was a mistake. There was no reason to.
It's a shame. It's such a
throw that in the face.
It's such a whistleblower that far beyond its you know value, editorial
but
value.
But I have a 7-year-old daughter now, and you know I watch the news at night, and I'd like to watch with her, but you know I really can't because you know too often you know like the other night I was watching with her, and Connie Chung says you know men who kill children coming up at 10 on. You know, I don't want to. I mean, I don't need that. It's 6:30 in the evening, you know. Anyway, so I left NPR. I left NPR, and I've been an independent television producer since. I've had a couple of companies, it would have been about 84. So about
right.
10 or 11 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did a 2-year gig doing a show on Congress called Capital Journal with Hodding Carter. But you know, but other than that, it's been all freelance work.
Yeah. Now it was John Leonard through whom I finally located you.
Oh, good for John.
As I think I sent a letter.
Yes.
And it just shows how insular this whole world is in which we live. That people that I know who are in broadcasting. On the West Coast, and so forth. Nobody knew where you were or what you were doing, and yet you know you're these are probably people who have watched your shows.
Yeah, that's,
and were and right. were not aware that they had done so.
Right.
And yeah. And it was finally John Leonard who had just done a review of something that you'd done on Normandy.
Oh yeah.
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 And reviewed it in a very complimentary fashion. He told me
probably the best thing I've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
Good show.
And was that a single show or was it a series?
No, it was a single show, a 90-minute special, 105 mm-hmm. minutes actually. Mm-hmm. And it's full.
Do you know if it got over to Britain?
Yes, it did. What happened in Britain was Discovery Britain ran it, but they did a, which I think is very appropriate actually in this case. They put a new narrator in. My narrator was Charles mm-hmm. Durning, who had been who was a veteran, American veteran from mm-hmm. the Stormy of the Beaches, and also an actor.
Yeah.
They took him out and put in a British veteran. Uh-huh. Who had stormed the beaches.
Yeah. But this was Discovery. Then that's the cable.
That's right.
It wasn't on...
I don't think it was on broadcast.
Ah, well, that explains why I missed it then.
I have a shortened version of it, which I'd be happy to give you, that Discovery did for their own air that has about 10 minutes taken out. Unfortunately, my full version, I sent the last one out yesterday. But remind me before I go, and I'll give you a copy of the shorter version.
I'd love it, because I've got facilities for playing American Standard Television.
All right, good. I'll give you this. It's not the long one, but I'm out of those. But it's still good.
I'd love to see it. Now there was one other thing I wanted to ask you. come on over here. Do you have any association with the WBAI these days? I mean, contact with it or with the people?
No, I hear about it through Frank Milspaugh.
Who
is, Frank has just been appointed to the board of Pacifica.
Oh.
Yes.
So right. Now is he located in New York?
Frank is in New York. Frank was my recommendation for station manager after Chris Albertson resigned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where is it? I write these things down, and I can't lose them in the book, but then I can't find them. I know. I wrote it back here. There was a woman called you may know her, Sally O'Brien. Do you know her?
No.
She's at the UN. She's a sort of, I think, technical person in charge there, but she has done a lot of programming for WBAI, and she's the granddaughter of Mary Heaton Vorse. Mary Heaton Vorse, of course, the Provincetown lady. I grew up in Provincetown. It was my hometown.
Oh, really?
And so her father, Joel O'Brien, who was a great voice himself in a whole lot of things, was older than me, but one of the other kids in town.
Yeah, right.
So that's goes back to my childhood. Anyway, Sally O'Brien, I didn't talk to her, but I got a message from her through a mutual friend in Provincetown. And I've just been in Provincetown for a couple of days.
Fabulous.
Back.
Yeah.
You say you can't go home again. God, I can't do anything else.
Right.
My life is totally déjà vu at the moment.
Yes.
and it's all working. But
so, what are the first 10 years that you're dealing with? What is your time period? 46 to 56, or?
Well, the first this thing that I already published was from 49, which was when it first went on
that's
the air,
right. Right.
up through 59, roughly, to just past the death of Lou Hill.
Yeah.
But having done this and circulated it to the people that I interviewed, one thing which really encouraged me was that people who, some of whom at the time had been at each other's throats, wrote back to me with wild enthusiasm about how fairly I had represented them.
That's nice.
I didn't get a single word of of criticism or regret from any of these people.
It was very fair-minded. Oh. I mean, Trevor's still around? Did you talk to Trevor?
I talked briefly to him, but not much, because at this point I was just on those first 10 years, and Trevor wasn't much of anybody at that time.
Harold hired me, and then Harold left.
Mm-hmm.
The chairman of the board was a dentist. What the hell was his name? Remember, the chairman of the board was a dentist.
Oh,
keep
yes.
drilling.
Gordon Agnew.
Gordon Agnew.
Yeah.
Yes,
Gordon
indeed.
Agnew, indeed. Yeah. Uh-huh. But the other thing that has happened is that these people are climbing all over my back to bring it up to date and make a book out of it.
Right.
And I don't have a publisher at this point. But things came together in a way that I won't waste time telling you about, that pointed in all together on a focal point of my coming over here for 5 weeks in the month of October, a little bit of September, a little bit of November afterwards. And
were you here through November?
Through this, the beginning of November.
Right, good. But, so you have a good amount of time. You know, I've always wanted to, I've tried on several occasions to sell a television program in Pacifica. I can't. Mm-hmm. Nobody's interested, But it would make fabulous cultural history, because, as you point out, mm-hmm. As you suggest, at least in that monograph, that it really is mm-hmm. a kind of wonderful history of the era that it was. I mean, of that era, from mm-hmm. at least in my experience, from 60 to mm-hmm. to 60, maybe even to 70. It's just mm-hmm. it really was such an interesting reflection of what was happening.
The history of Pacifica is, in many respects, the cultural and the political history of America.
Exactly.
At its nodal points.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a gal named Veronica Silver in Oakland who is sort of working on a Pacifica film, I'm told.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. But that's been going on for a number of years, and nothing particularly has happened.
No.
There's been what I heard from O'Brien was that a book has come out. The report that I got was that it was on Pacifica and centered particularly on WBAI, called Riding the FM Bands.
Name is familiar to me, but
renamed Pond.
I think it'd be a Bob Fass book. About himself.
It was by somebody named, God, where did I write it down here?
I have two PhD dissertations on Pacifica.
Two?
I think so.
I've got one. Post is the name of this
Steve
person.
Oh, Steve Post. Oh, that's about himself. I mean, that's worth reading. I mean, no. Steve is great, though. Steve Post and Bob Fass and Frank Milspaugh, those three, they represent the next phase.
Ah, I see.
I mean, they carry Pacifica into the next phase. And at the beginning of that phase, I think it was fabulously exciting. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of got, but I mean, Bob, there was a period in New York where Bob Fass could get on the air and say, come out to the, let's have a demonstration here. And 100,000 people would show up. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was incredibly powerful.
Steve Post.
That's Steve Post. Yeah, mm-hmm. he's Steve Post. And Frank would know how to get a hold of him, Frank Milspaugh. Mm-hmm. And Frank and Bob Fass, and those were the three principals, I think.
Yeah. See, at this stage, I don't know how far I'm going with this. I'm concentrating particularly on KPFA and on the West Coast, because that's what I know. Yeah. It's my story as well as their story. Yeah. I was commanded when I did this to write it in the first person, that first 10 years that I did, and not try to play the objective reporter everything.
But you were objective. You were very fair.
Yeah, and because as you will have noticed, as an old radio person, the
is Vera still alive?
Yes, she is.
Because she'd be a mine of.
Oh yes, I got a lot from her, and she was She was very favorably impressed with the report. She said, wrote back to me and said she couldn't find anything wrong.
Sounds like Vera hasn't changed at all.
Yeah, yeah. That was fine with me.
Yeah.
But I want to stay on this to begin with. I mean to go outwards from a center that I know. And how far out I go is going to be a question of time and money and all sorts of things. But as I say, I don't have a publisher. I've got one friend who's in CD-ROM who was giving me a strong nibble. And that, of course, would take it into the area of being able to present excerpts from programs as well,
absolutely.
Which is, after all, what it's about.
Yeah,
without it, in a way, it's like a book about a book of art history without any reproductions in it.
No, you're right. Yeah, that's right.
Yes. But the important thing to me is that we're talking about a focal point of integrity and a focal point of, not to put too fine a point on it, artistic excellence.